This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, that ship has sailed. Happy endings, fan service, and the appropriate finale.
Warning to all our listeners, the following podcast will contain spoilers for the end of A Court of Wings and Ruin from Sarah J. Maas's A Court of Thorns and Roses series, the Black Magician trilogy by Trudy Canavan, and a number of other books, because we're obviously going to be discussing endings. So you've been warned.
You've been warned. So spoiler alert ahead. Yeah, basically we've done an episode on disappointing endings where the author hasn't really paid off before. And this one is looking at what you particularly find, particularly in young adult fiction, is the happily ever after.
So yes.
When it pays off, when it doesn't, and when it works out better that it's balanced by something a bit more bittersweet.
Yes. Now, I think it's fair to say that we're probably going to spend the first few minutes gushing about A Court of Wings and Ruin.
Well, I think you're going to spend the first few minutes gushing about it.
Oh dear! That doesn't sound good. This is actually one of those really odd occasions where I finished a book before Jules did.
I know, I thought I'd entered a different plane of reality.
I know.
Talking about it on Facebook, it's like, you can't have read it already, it's literally just come out.
I nabbed it quick. And got through it even quicker. Yeah, Jules and I swapped places. It was all very confusing. So you sound like you have reservations, Jules.
It didn't impress me very much. It felt rushed. I didn't like the way it was written, and I thought the pacing was off.
Okay. Gosh.
There were good bits in the book, but in my opinion, it needed another two passes with a really good editor before it went anywhere.
So, wow.
That's how I feel about it.
I was not expecting that. I must say, I was not expecting that, because I loved it. I really, really, really loved it.
I think you must have been able to switch off the constantly being pulled up short by the fragmented and broken prose, which I could not make myself switch off from, and I very nearly didn't finish it a couple of times.
Really?
Really, it was that bad.
Goodness me.
It was literally the last 100 pages pulled it up from 2 stars to 3 stars for me.
Oh my gosh. I'm really surprised. Because, yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. A lot.
Yeah, a lot of people have been, and quite a few other people when I've posted an update saying, okay, the idiosyncratic punctuation is doing my head in now. A lot of people have come to me and said, oh my god, you too! So I think it really depends. I think if there was enough of the part of the story you wanted to see that it drew you in so that you just didn't see those bits anymore, then probably you really enjoyed it. But if there wasn't enough of that plot that drew you in, then it probably just really irritated you all the way through like it did with me.
Well, I think one of the problems I had was that it was... And again, this is, I'm not sure whether it counts as a problem, but I mean, it was a problem. It was too perfect in a lot of ways. Like, the relationship between Rhys and Feyre was literally just too perfect.
That was one of my big problems, because it was still being used to drive the plot, but because there was no conflict between the two of them, there wasn't anything to drive the plot, so it was quite limp. Unlike Rhys and, who was pretty much permanently erect.
Yeah, like, I get, you know, that obviously that they've just been mated, so there was the frenzy thing a little bit. But, I mean, it wasn't just that. I didn't mind actually not having to deal with some sort of, like, oh god, maybe she's going to fall in love with someone else kind of rubbish or anything like that. I didn't mind that they were just a unit throughout. But everything was too perfect. And you'll notice that more often than not, they actually resort to violence quite a lot. They resort to violence quite a lot, and it's written off because it's all okay, because all of the other characters are just despicable enough to deserve it. And I'm always a little bit sort of like, wait, what? Are we not going to talk about what you've just done and what you're doing? And then they're all there like, oh, but we're the good guys. And I'm like, no, you just beat someone half to death. This is like vigilante justice to sort of going to the next level. And obviously all of these people, these are the kinds of people that you would want to smack. These are the kinds of people who you really despise. And I just thought, it's a bit annoying. It's a little bit convenient that all of these characters who get in their way are also the kinds of people that we're automatically going to hate. Like, you can't have a reasonable person just getting in their way saying, no, I'm not sure I agree with you. But it's always, I'm not sure I agree with you. Also, I beat children. And therefore, it's okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah, basically, if A Court of Wings and Ruin was a Marvel superhero, it would be the Punisher.
It was a... That being said, there was an element of satisfaction about it, because you didn't have to... You know, I'm there complaining about it, and, you know, for me, that makes it sort of a little bit unrealistic. But, you know, they're all fairies, so I guess... Oh, shit, I said the word.
What's that, something clinking into the F jar?
Never mind that I just said the S word. Yeah, so, you know, they're all fairies, so that also, you know, deters from reality a little bit. There's lots to deter from reality, so I don't mind it. But it was a little bit, the whole thing felt a little bit like wish fulfillment, which is someone who wanted wish fulfillment, I was kind of happy to read. I was happy to just go, yeah, okay, that isn't very realistic. Yeah, okay, these characters are too perfect. Yeah, okay. Because at this point, I already knew who they were. I was already invested in them. And I just wanted a happy ending. I didn't want my heart to be broken. So I guess that part of me just kind of let it happen in some ways. I just let myself be pulled through, and I enjoyed it. And I liked some of the twists that she had in there. And there were actually a couple of moments where there were some interesting compromises, where, for instance, Friesand opens up the city. What's it called again?
What's Belarus, the city? Isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. He opens it up to the Court of Nightmares in exchange. That was an interesting, you know, that was a give a little, take a little. But that was kind of the only real example of true sacrifice that I really felt in my gut. Until the end, where Sarah J. Maas started to sort of channel Trudy Canavan a little bit, and Reeson died.
Yeah, but did you believe for one moment he was going to stay dead? Because I didn't. And then it's literally like three paragraphs and he's back to life again.
I know.
And it's like, you can't pull that. You can't pull that card and just and do it like that. That's really lame.
Well, the thing is, I did actually have a heart stop moment. Because everything else had gone so perfectly. And I think that a part of me has remained and will always be traumatised by how Trudy Canavan ended The High Lord. Because I think that was the first time in my life that I'd ever read a book where one of the main characters died like that. For context, the end of The High Lord, the Black Magician trilogy, Acheron and Sonya are fighting, and Acheron gives Sonya some of his power, and he keeps giving it to her, in a very similar way that Rhysand does with Feyre. But what happens is that when Sonya turns around, because they've managed to win, Acheron is dead, because he gave her everything he got.
Yeah.
And he died, and sort of Trudy Canavan describes that he still has that kind of small half smile on his face. And my heart shattered. I was so upset because you start the series hating him and then he goes. Like, even now I'm getting upset. There's been two character deaths that have deeply and hugely affected me. And this has got to be one of them. One of the ones that I'll never quite forgive. And so when that happened to Rhysand, I think I got kind of chill because I had a flashback to like a 14-year-old me sitting in my bed weeping like, no. And then I thought, no way, no way is he going to stay dead. No way can she keep him dead. And of course, he comes back to life. And everyone gets paired off except for Az. Okay, Moore, I guess, doesn't have a pair, doesn't have someone at the end. Az and Mor have still got their weird sort of thing going on, the unrequited love. And then you have the complicated affair, which is Lucien and Elaine. But that's just set up for the next book, I think.
Yeah, and it was quite clearly left hanging.
Yeah.
Deliberately. Same with Nesta and Cassian.
Though they had more of a resolve. They got to kiss, and Cassian was all sort of, I'll find you in the next life. And oh my god, if there ever was a character I thought was actually going to die, it was Cassian. Okay, he got gutted, almost disintegrated, and then had most of the bones in his body broken. I literally don't understand. But the problem was that by the end of it, actually, I was kind of desensitized to fear of these characters' deaths because they were so indestructible. They really were so indestructible. Cassian gets gutted, and then like half an hour later he's been healed up and they're like, you're fine, you'll be fine in a couple of days, and that's that.
Yeah, and it's, you're never really anxious about any of them ultimately.
Yeah.
And I think that was the same. You were left on such an amazing, not even a cliffhanger, but with such an amazing setup for this book after A Court of Mist and Fury.
Yeah.
And once you got onto this one, you know, you were barely a couple of chapters into the book before Rhys has pretty much said through the mating bond, oh yeah, they're fine, they're healing, everybody's still alive, kind of thing. And then they really are when she finally gets there. They're fine. Absolutely yeah. fine.
Which I didn't mind. It would have been nice to see a little bit of drama. I mean, I wonder what would have happened if Cassian had lost the ability to fly.
Yeah, that would have been interesting. Another thing that might have been interesting, which would have been massively unpopular, is instead of going off to the Spring Court and basically sabotaging things in a way that made her seem really quite petty and spiteful, Feyre could have gone in properly and properly tried to get Tamlin on her side. They could have made it a much bigger deal, and perhaps that would have caused some, you know, earthquakes in her relationship with Rhys that she then has to work out in the second half of the book. That would have made a lot more sense. Instead, it was sort of squandered.
Well, I don't know, because I quite liked what it was very petty, but I can kind of understand why she was being petty. And in the end, it's sort of, she is sort of punished for it when she realizes, oh yeah, I kind of caused this problem out of pettiness. But I did actually quite enjoy the whole scenes because I was there giggling. But I did think more would come out of it. Like, for instance, rather than her then just running off, she would then take over the Spring Court instead.
Yeah, it felt, I don't know, like Sarah J. Maas went all gun shy or something and had something else in mind and just went, oh, no, 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 I can't do that.
I don't know.
Or that she hadn't thought it through.
I mean, I don't know. I really enjoyed the book. I got through it very, very quickly. And maybe if I give it a reread, I'll sort of start to spot some sort of problems with it. But actually, Feyre is a little bit petty at times.
Yes, but nobody ever calls her on it.
I know.
Why doesn't Rhys ever call her on it? Why doesn't he say, well, you know what? You know, I love you and everything, and I think you're wonderful, but what you did was kind of a shitty thing to do.
Because Rhys is also a bit petty, so yeah, he probably approved.
She does kind of call him on things, so he ought to do the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I found him completely toothless in this book. He had no agency whatsoever. He was almost like an accessory. That was one of my other problems.
Really?
Yeah.
It's interesting to talk to you about it.
We haven't discussed this book at all until now.
No, so. We haven't. So you were not satisfied by the ending?
I felt it was, you know, it was all right as an ending. It wrapped things up. The last battle kind of thing was slightly more interesting and did actually engage me, but ultimately, mm-hmm. a lot of it felt contrived. Her father turning up on a ship. Her father has had no agency for two books.
I and liked that, though.
Yeah, but he turned up just in time to have a noble death. And it's like, when did you learn to fight? Because they haven't been at war that long. It was stupid. it was contrived.
You're pulling the bunches, are you?
No, but it was stupid. And, no, you know how much I love Amarin, but she should have died. That should have been it.
Yeah, they all lived. All of them lived.
That was so unbelievably contrived, bringing her back as well. I hate contrivance, basically.
Oh, I wouldn't have noticed, Joel.
So I'm slightly frustrated because there's enough really good stuff there that you can see the book it could have been, which, you know, is quite an arrogant thing to say because ultimately it's not my book. I didn't write it. but at the same time, I've invested a lot of time in this series and I feel a bit shortchanged.
Ah, I'm sorry to hear that. I as I said, it did feel a little bit like wish fulfillment. And actually, usually I might have a problem with that, but I didn't really mind that so much this time. And it might be because of all the sort of turbulent kind of things that are happening at the moment. But I wonder whether that's not actually kind of what we needed. That everyone lives just this once, everyone survives.
Yeah, possibly.
Good and prevails.
Also, it depends where you are on your, you know, journey as a reader, because books will appear differently to you depending on where you are in your life and what's going on in your life at the time.
Yeah.
And for me, that was just kind of, I didn't necessarily even mind them all living, ultimately. I mean, I still think the Amryn thing was a bit daft. And I don't want her to die because she's by far the best character, in my opinion. But there's not enough sacrifice. There's no balance, really.
Yeah. I think ultimately one of the problems, they were a bit too powerful. And they were a bit sort of, yeah. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to know. And again, I'm saying all this, but ultimately I enjoyed the book. And it appealed to that part of me that is desperate for a happy ending. Absolutely desperate. And it really, it just, the book is perfect in that it just rounds itself off perfectly. In a way that is jarringly unrealistic and yet is still entertainment, as far as I'm concerned. I liked it.
It is the Mills and Boone of fantasy novels. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But yeah, you know, everyone's really powerful, everyone's really rich, everyone ends up with the person they want, more or less.
Except for Az. Poor Az. To be honest, I thought that Az at least would die. It would have solved a few things, to be honest.
Yes, I still think that that was intended initially to go in a completely different direction and that she bowed to pressure there a bit. And I don't necessarily mind the fact of the direction it took, but again, it feels like it wasn't set up properly.
With what?
With Moore's big revelation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I liked it, and I did feel like there was suddenly a lot of you get to the end, it's bisexuals and homosexuals everywhere. I just thought, where have they been for this whole series?
I don't have a problem with it, but it is a bit like Feyre's at some point between wars has popped off to an LGBTQA+ type meeting, found out about all this stuff, and suddenly noticed who's sleeping with who.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, is when you start shoehorning representation, it becomes sort of a bit tokenist.
Especially when it just, yeah, literally, it all happened within a very short period of time, where it's like, oh, that's his lover, and they're both men. I'm like, oh, that's great. And then, don't get me wrong, I like the idea that Moore might be about it. There was a bit confused about what she was. Is she a lesbian or is she bisexual? And if she's bisexual, what's the problem with Az? Or is it that she's bisexual but really does prefer women but she can be with men? Like, I guess that's what it is.
She sort of read a bit more like, well, actually, I'm a lesbian, but I sleep with men, so no one realises.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. But then, you know, she says I sleep with men. But then she says sometimes I'm, you know, she likes it or something like that. And I'm like, but then, and I don't know. No, I wasn't quite sure what was going on.
Aside from the fact that, again, it was a bit contrived, and I don't think that was the direction it was originally intended to go in. It's the fact that was actually really quite a callow, cruel thing for that character to do, and was really out of character for that character. So we're saying for 500 years she's been stringing someone along.
Yeah.
500 years? Really? And Feyre has just come along and now she wants to talk about it?
Well, I mean, like, she's not necessarily been stringing Az along. She said no. Or rather, you know, she's turned, and but he's stuck around. I don't know. It's all complicated.
She's never, ever had the conversation. She says stringing along herself.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, it's also useful that people think that I'm straight, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's not really a great representation of somebody who is coming to terms with their sexuality, is it?
No. Yeah. I like the idea that Morrigan might be a lesbian. That would be fantastic. I would really like that. But it does feel like it wasn't really dealt with properly.
Yeah.
In fact, The only, but again, and this is the only sort of twist that I really did like, that again was a little bit too perfect, but I still really like it, was the one with Lucian and who his father was.
Oh, actually, that kind of worked. I quite liked Hellion, actually.
Hellion was interesting, though I made the observation, which was, so that was why Lucian always had to be miserable, because if he got too happy, he'd start glowing.
Yes, basically.
So that's why everyone's like, quick, quick, make him miserable. He can't be too happy or he'll know.
Anyway, in fairness to the fact that obviously A Court of Wings and Ruin was just not what I was looking for at the time, and that has to inform how I've perceived it, or compare it to something that came along that a lot of people were really booing when it originally came out, and I was kind of like, yeah, I can see this is bad, but at the same time, I really like how it ended. And that was Breaking Dawn. And a lot of people felt that that was all very, that it really pulled its punches because it didn't turn into a physical fight at the end between the good vampires and the bad vampires kind of thing. And you have all those tantalizing extra powers and things, and they're never used. It really is just a Merchant of Venice where everything is one with words. Obviously, I'm talking about the book, not the film, because the film had a major, major plot hole that I just don't want to get into. But and I at the time I was thinking, well, yeah, there's a couple of really icky things in this book as well, in fairness, but I just enjoyed it for what it was at the time. So again, it is kind of where you are and what you're actually looking for out of a book, because everybody lives at the end of Breaking Dawn as well. There is a moment where you genuinely do think, yeah, they're probably all going to die because they're massively, massively outgunned, and outnumbered. But at the same time, you kind of think, well, they probably won't die because, Stephanie Meyer, she's not going to kill them all off.
No, but it comes to a question of whether letting everyone live at the end, especially in these sort of epic stories where there's battles and stuff like that, whether that's juvenile. And I think a part of me did used to think that actually, as you sort of get, if you want to write grittier things, if you want to write realistic things, you kind of do have to sort of kill them all at the end. And actually, I sort of got challenged by my mother. This is a bit of a sad story. It's not a sad story, but whilst I was writing the Children of Arimathea, and I was with her, and my mother had terminal cancer, and this was, I think, the last holiday I had with her, and I was reading bits to her, and I said, oh, I'm really struggling. Because I think I need to kill this character. And she said, why do you need to kill them? And I said, this just I need this character, I need to kill this character. But I didn't want to kill them, because it would have hurt. And there were other characters I knew I was going to kill, and I was prepared to do that. But this one character, I wasn't really prepared to kill them, even though I knew it would be good for the story if I did. There would be, I knew that if I did it, there would be this wound within me, like an actual wound, that would stay with me. It really, really would. I genuinely do mourn sometimes for characters. They really, really does upset me. And my mother said, then why don't you let them live? And I said, well, I've got to do what's best for the story. And she said, the thing about it, though, is that when you write, you're in control of it. So you can decide. And it struck me that we were there where I was in this situation, in a life where I was about to lose my mother. And there was nothing I could do about it. And these things were out of my control, and I just lost my grandfather. And these things were happening, and they were real, and they were painful. And then I had this thing that was completely in my control, and I realized that there was nothing wrong with actually deciding, no, I don't care if people turn around and say, well, that's just unrealistic, because I'm not writing this book to be realistic. I'm writing this book to escape from what's happening and to discuss what's happening and to sort of, to highlight it. And it's not like there are any shortages of deaths at the end of the Children of Arimathea. But I was allowed to be picky, to sort of pick and choose a little bit more. So I think since that moment, I've stopped poo-pooing stories that end happily, and I've sort of gotten really back into kind of the those ultimate feel good everyone wins at the end stories.
I suppose the thing is, not everybody has to die, and maybe, or not, maybe not anybody has to die, but you must feel during the story that they could do. As a
Yeah.
reader, you must feel that they are in danger during the story. Otherwise, why, what's the point in reading it?
Yeah. And again, it's we bring it down to death. And it doesn't actually need to be death. There are other ways
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a physical
doing
death. It,
sacrifice.
yeah, it could be a death of character, death of a prejudice. It could be, death of an ability.
Yeah.
Could
I
be death
mean,
of able-bodiedness.
yeah. And again, sort of we look again, I mentioned it, Court of Wings and Ruin. One of the bits that really hurt me was a recent relenting with his relenting and allowing the Night Court into the Court of Dreams. Another good example is Full Metal Alchemist, where at the end of Full Metal Alchemist, the main character, Edward Elric, who is this prodigy in alchemy, and has, used it throughout and is really, really good. He gets what he wanted, which was to save his brother, and he gets back his arm as well. But in doing so, he loses his alchemy, which was sort of a part of his identity up until this point. It was a big part of who he was because it was who he'd made himself in order to sort of get things back. But even before that, he was this alchemist and he lost it at the end. And so he was a different person and he wasn't able to go back to the job that he was doing. He had to forge a sort of new life for himself, as a new person. And that was a satisfying end, especially because his little brother could still do alchemy and all of his friends, they could still do alchemy and they could still do what they were doing. He was the one who had to sacrifice it. And he lived, his brother lived, he got the girl, they started a family. It was a happy ending. But it was a change, and it felt complete and real. And that, as far as I'm concerned, A Fullmetal Alchemist is one of the finest stories I've ever read. And that's the second story where a character has died and has had a deeply profound effect on me. And that was Maes Hughes, who was that was the first time a character had died, and I really was sobbing. I was so upset. So fantastic storytelling, as far as I'm concerned. And a perfect example of an ending where death wasn't the sacrifice, another sacrifice was given, and it was used to good effect.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's worth remembering that pretty much all of the Fellowship of the Ring survived.
Pretty much none of the Hobbit guys do, and yet which one is meant for the ch meant for children?
Yeah, it's quite interesting that. But in some ways, the state that Bilbo's left in at the end of The Lord of the Rings, at the end of The Return of the King,
Yeah.
he's never going to be the same again, to the point where he cannot exist in anything like the same life he had before. The sacrifice has literally been of his internal self.
You mean Bilbo or Frodo? Or both
I
of
mean
them, I
Frodo,
guess.
not Bilbo. Bilbo loses himself along the way. You're quite right. I mean Frodo. Yeah, because he sails into the east with the elves, doesn't he?
Yeah. And yeah, the fellowship does kind of
And
break up, I guess, in some
yeah,
ways.
it obviously it has to. It was a temporary situation, but in some ways that sort of hurts a bit more because there's no re real reward for him, and you sort
No.
of feel like he should be rewarded. Even though he failed ultimately, you feel like he should be rewarded.
But yeah, we I mean again we've talked about it is that he failed but actually succeeded because his ultimate strength was his kindness.
Yeah, okay. This isn't really a character death, but a bittersweet ending that really affected me as a child and then all the way up. The Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle. And it's not okay. Lear does die briefly. He gets tossed by the Red Bull, and you think he's gone, but his death actually galvanizes the unicorn to really fight the bull. And she drives the bull into the sea, and then all the unicorns are released from the tide. So the unicorns are back in the world again, and she manages to heal Lear, but there's no way back. She can't go back to being a woman. And they were really properly in love, and they're divided forever because he's one thing and she's another. And you're left with the sense that even though she's an immortal creature and she's never known regret before, she will always know regret now. And that really stayed with me. Admittedly, when I first watched the film, I think I was about 7 years old. And at the part where the unicorn gets turned into a woman, I burst into tears and started yelling for my mother because this was not how that story should play out.
I sense a bad idea.
Obviously, I understand it a little bit more now. But at the time, it was like, that was really traumatic. I liked animals better than people. I did not want to see the unicorn turned into a person.
Yeah.
But all that's aside, but the end of The Last Unicorn is really quite affecting in that respect, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. And again, not character death, but sacrifice.
And what they're sacrificing is this, it's just this ordinary love between two people, but they can't have it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of, actually, there's another story that I read quite recently where there was a sacrifice that actually deeply hurt me. And that was yours, Jules, in Stalking the Leviathan, also with the unicorn.
Oh, right, yeah, the Garden of Earthly Sorrows.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was sorrows. There were many sorrows. yeah, so in that story, there's this absolute pure love. I mean, the character is an asexual, and she sacrifices that part of her, isn't she? She has sex with someone, which she doesn't really want to do, and she does that also that she can save the unicorn, and in doing so she ruins her relationship with the unicorn, and it really upset me. They all lived, but it really upset me.
See, I sort of
they
feel
lived
like...
divided.
I sort of feel like I should apologize, but at the same time that's kind of what the reaction I was going for.
I know it was the reaction. I was there on the plane just reading it like, oh, you bitch. You bitch.
And yeah, to be honest, I copped quite a bit of flack for that. Not because people were upset with that ending, but they didn't like the sense that she perhaps sacrificed what could be perceived as virtue and had less value as a woman who was fallen. And that's not what I was going for at all. What I was going for was the fact that special communion of understanding she and the unicorn had, where they could pretty much only bear each other's touch, even though it was completely sexless.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't match anymore. She had knowledge the unicorn didn't have and couldn't have, because the unicorn's non-binary, because why do anything by halves? So she'd lost the qualification to tame him.
Yeah. No, but as in, I got that as well. I also saw it as that she'd harmed herself. That the perfection or that kind of thing was lost, not because she'd had sex, but because she'd done something which she didn't actually want to do.
Yeah.
She'd sacrificed a part of herself, hurt herself for the unicorn. So that was a very good example of sacrifice without death and a satisfying ending, which still hurt. Now, I believe you want to talk about a book which ended that I was very unhappy about, with an ending that I was very unhappy about.
Yes, Daughter of the Forest by Juliette Mirelier, which is probably is my favourite of Juliette Mirelier's books. It's a retelling of the Celtic fairy tale of the wild swans, and it's really, really well done. There are, you know, she's really given the characters life in the story.
Yeah.
But in the book, the first brother she meets is actually Simon, the younger brother, and she meets him when she's really still a child, under unusual circumstances, where she's called on to help heal him, and he's traumatised after having been tortured by her own family. And it's only later that this leads her, when she's in hiding from the sorceress, to be picked up and looked after by the older brother, and eventually they fall in love with each other. Meanwhile, Simon has been missing for a long time, and we later find out that he's been abducted under a fairy mound, basically. But he's never forgotten Saoirse. And when he comes back at the very end, it's too late for them, because Saoirse's fallen in love with her older brother, his older brother, a different story.
There's incest later, though. Sorry.
She's not only fallen in love with him, she's married him. It could be annulled, because obviously it hasn't been consummated, but, you know, the church sort of frowns on you marrying your sibling's ex.
Tell that to Henry VIII.
Sarah's brother was dead, but yes, good, exactly. So she was out of his reach forever, really.
Yeah.
And in a way, you kind of think, well, no offence, Simon. Okay, the way I come at it is, Simon has spent his entire life always seeing himself as the least of something, which wasn't the case, and the fact that he's always envied what his older brother had, when in fact his older brother has had all the responsibility and hasn't really had a lot of fun or a lot of choice or whatever, and the one thing he does choose for himself, the one thing he breaks all the rules for, is Saoirse. And you can see that he's a better person for her than Simon would have been.
I agree. Don't get me wrong, the reason I didn't like the ending of the book wasn't actually because of that. I understood why they did what they did. I wouldn't have minded if maybe Simon and Red sort of came to peace with one another. But that was never going to happen with Simon, which is fair enough. But no, the bit that really upset me about the whole thing is that Saoirse or Saoirse goes through this entire ordeal. And it is an ordeal. She goes through so much pain to bring her brothers back and turn them back from swans and into humans. And almost instantly, when she does that, they all go home and several of them go off to war and get killed, like, instantly. And they all just, that's it. They get home and then they just split ways.
Yeah.
And I just thought, for the love of God, just stay together for a little while. Jesus.
No, and in a way, that does feel like it sort of spitting back in her teeth. But in all fairness, it was kind of like their life was in hiatus until she completed her task. And after that, you know, they didn't, you know, they owed her a lot of respect, and she was probably the one of the few people who got to control her own life after that. But at the same time, they couldn't all stay together. The whole point was so that they could go off in their own separate ways, even though it's really horrible. The one I was really upset about was Finbar, to be honest.
Yeah, that was very painful.
Although later you find out what happened to him.
Yeah, Finbar's the one who's closer to her age, and he sort of only gets half turned back. He's still got a wing, doesn't he? And what happened was that he mated with another swan, and yeah.
Swan's mate for life as well.
Swan's mate for life. Though actually, we're not going to talk about the reality of what swans do, because they mate for life, but then they commit adultery with other swans, and to be honest, it's just... Yeah, I don't know. But it's not as sort of pure as you think. Every time I admire swans, my partner likes to remind me that they're literally scum of the earth. They will swim in anything. They will eat anything. They're violent. They have no standards. They will just, any kind of water, it doesn't matter to them. Like, they're really dirty creatures. So that kind of helped alleviate the pain for me a little bit. That they're actually not these elegant creatures. They're these, you know, bottom feeders. So yeah, that aside,
a couple more that actually really affected me. This one really, really hit me when I was about 14. The Oaken Throne by Robin Jarvis.
Oh, Robin Jarvis.
You're gonna have to hold on to your disbelief a little bit with this one, because the bats are at war with the squirrels.
Of course,
in medieval Britain.
Yes.
And it's a huge battle over resurrecting the ancient gods and preventing it from happening. And the whole war between the bats and the squirrels has been to distract them.
I have to pause you very quickly, because I've been writing a synopsis, right? Like working on a synopsis for the last couple of days. And they're really hard to write. And now I'm just trying to imagine Jarvis trying to put the synopses together to send off to an agent and say, like, so we've got bats and squirrels, okay, and they're at war about resurrecting ancient gods in a medieval world. Get out.
Well, if you want to know how Robin Jarvis did it, I think he sketched the characters and just sent the sketchbook without any explanation, and they said, is there a story to go with it? Because he's an extremely talented artist, so that's how it was done.
Fair enough.
Anyway, but you've got this kind of Romeo and Juliet thing going on, where they start off hating each other, the young squirrel who's going to be the star wife, and the basically a knight of the moon, a young bat. And by the end of the book, they're in love with each other, you know, which poses a lot of problems. A
lot of problems.
But there is a prophecy made earlier in the book to the bat saying that you'll meet your death surrounded by bells. And, you know, she rejects him because she's kind of like, well, everybody, wherever we go, will shun us because we're together. Even though, you know, someone else who's setting up a colony elsewhere has said, you know what, you'd be welcome. We don't care that you're the wrong species for each other, kind of thing. It's done quite delicately because it's a children's book. But she says, no, I've got a responsibility. I have to be the star wife now because the acorn fell to me. I have to do it, kind of thing. So she rejects him and he's left in the field alone. And a peddler comes along. Now, if you've read any fairy tales, you never trust the peddler. Particularly not the peddler who doesn't put their hood back and says, oh, come on, drink this toast of mead with me today, etc., etc., in honour of the new star wife. So he does, and peddler then throws the hood back, and it's the jester who's been betraying them all along, who's dead, but he's allowed to come back because he made this bargain and prophecy that the bat would meet his doom surrounded by bells. Mm-hmm. The bat is surrounded by bluebells at the time, and the toast was poison. And at this point, the star wife, Isabel, is basically saying, you know what, I don't want to be crowned star wife. I think I'm going to go with the bat after all. Screw you lot. She runs off to find him and he's dead when she gets there.
That's just not acceptable.
And this is Robin Jarvis. So they have gone through absolute hell to get to that point at the end where they have actually in some way won. And she's banished an ancient god back into the, you know, back into the earth. So she, you know, they literally have gone through hell, and by the time she gets there, having changed her mind, he's gone.
That just hurts.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was pretty affecting at the time.
It's an entire generation of children who will have been completely traumatised.
The other one that gets me is the last book in Tamora Pierce's Becca Cooper series, Mastiff. And Becca Cooper's really sort of come along as a medieval police officer.
Mm-hmm.
Or a dog, as they're called. And they get towards the end of the book, and she can't work out, she knows that someone is betraying them, and she can't work out whether it's her new lover, who she, you know, she's pretty damn certain she's going to marry, whether it's her old partner, who's been almost like a father to her, or whether it's the lady knight who's been working with them, who she's been friends with for a really long time. It's a bad choice either way. And then you get to the end of the book and you find out, I mean, at this point in the book, I was kind of like, or it could be none of them. It could be none of them. They could all be fine. They could all live, kind of thing. Because what's happened is that the prince had been kidnapped. The 3 or 4 year old prince had been kidnapped and sold into slavery. And it's all tied up with this seedy, dirty underworld of slavery and, you know, sex trafficking and all sorts. And it's just really horrible, pretty gritty stuff.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be her partner, and I can't think of a solution to that book whereby any of the three choices of the people who were betraying them, it would be acceptable. But it really, really hurt because they had a really, really good relationship as, you know, B coppers together.
Oh.
And they're actually, because it's not enough that she finds out he betrayed her and everyone else. It's the fact that she then has to take him in, and he refuses to be taken in alive, so they fight to the death.
Oh.
I mean, there's a really, really nasty execution waiting for you on top of Traitor's Hill if you did get taken in. But in the end, he's had a previous injury, so what she does is smash his legs again, and she takes him in, and luckily for her, because she doesn't really want to hand him over for the sort of death you get on Traitor's Hill, he dies of shock in the night. But it is utterly horrific.
This is why I'm all for children's books having happy ending again now. We've just... our generation were traumatised. Your generation were traumatised. Enough!
I think in some ways, though, it's made me feel that if you get to an ending and everything is almost saccharinely perfect, then it's not a proper ending. As in, there has to be a little bit of bitter to make the sweet go down, or to make you appreciate the sweet, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think it comes to an element of the fact that, especially in children's books, and especially in sort of YA and epic kind of stories, the whole premise is that something has changed at the end. And when we change, there is sacrifice in life. So if you get to the end and everything's just perfect, it's probably jarring because it's unrelatable. We're not perfect. Even when we become better people, we're not perfect, or we've had to sacrifice, or we've had to go through something. Change usually comes because of pressure, because of hardship and things along those lines. So it's very, it wouldn't be natural if there wasn't sort of scars from that.
Yeah, I'm writing book 4 of Unveiled at the moment, and I can tell you all right now that a major character dies before the end of the book.
Don't do this to me.
I'm not going to tell you who, but gird your loins, people. And, you know, it's really hurting me because there is no way around it. If it isn't this person, it has to be somebody else. But there is no way for there to be the right sort of balance without killing off somebody.
I swear to God, Jules. I swear to God, if you... I'm already hacking someone's limbs off because someone annoyed me on Twitter, so...
Someone annoyed you on Twitter?
Gareth provoked me, so now losing a limb. Someone is losing a limb. but, you know, if you hurt me, Jules, I will hurt you.
Well, it won't be done to hurt you. It'll be done because the story requires it.
Yes, but you'll hurt me and I will hurt you. I can write sad endings as well.
Seriously, it's hurting me. It really is, but I've got to do it.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Killing people is hard, and killing characters is harder.
Yes.
You're just going to let that slip, huh?
No, I'm totally on board with that. Just probably a little bit worrying.
Oh, dear. Well, I think we're running out of time.
We are. Okay, final question for you.
Okay.
Of all your ongoing projects and things,
mm-hmm.
which one has the ending that we need to watch out for?
Well, if you push me too hard, you're going to have to watch out for Hamartia Cycle, because I will bring it to its knees. But it should have a happy ending, provided you don't hurt me too badly. I wonder, because I am a sucker for happy endings, but I think if there's any that you probably might need to watch out for, Hamartia Cycle will have an ending that stings just a little bit. It will be happy, but it'll sting a little bit. But the Kestrel Saga might very well have something that people are going to be surprised and not very happy about. Small grumble.
That's me reserving judgment for now.
What about you? Should I be really preparing myself for book 4?
Let's just say it'll be a bit of an emotional roller coaster.
Don't you hurt my babies! I'm already crying. I don't even know who's going to die yet, and I'm already crying.
Oh.
Well, what about you guys? Message us, leave us a comment, and tell us which characters just didn't have to die in books, or books that you found the ending to be unsatisfactory, or books where you found the ending to be very satisfactory. Leave a comment below, and yeah, until next time.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.